Well, welcome once again to Gardener's Question Time. This week we're the guests of the Pendle and District Horticultural Society. So, without further ado, may we have the first question, please?
Mrs. Mavis Williams, when walking through woods, one sees so many beautiful varieties of mushrooms and fungi. Could the panel tell me how to distinguish the edible from the poisonous varieties?
Right, well, Stefan.
Well, Mrs. Williams, the short answer is that unless you're with an expert, you should never eat any wild fungus, as most of them are extremely poisonous.
Jeffrey, care to add to that?
Well, indeed they are. In fact, so poisonous that even a small dose could be fatal.
So there we are, Mrs. Williams. The answer is don't touch any wild fungus. And the next question, please.
Sorry, excuse me, but which fungus is the most lethal of all?
Well, they're all very dangerous, actually.
I see, thank you.
And the next question, please.
And when you say a small dose, how small is small?
Stefan, what would you say, a plateful?
Less?
Less than a plateful, I see.
Obviously, it depends on the size and the age of the person eating.
Yes, yes, well, moving on.
What about a man of 38-ish, medium height? 11 stone, 3 pounds, you know, for example. Would a plateful be enough?
Probably. Can we have the next question, please?
Yes, in a south-facing garden, loamy soil, which is more likely to thrive, foxglove or deadly nightshade?
Stefan, I think this is your area, really.
Well, of course, the interesting thing about both the plants you mentioned is that despite being very attractive and hardy numbers, they are, of course, both highly poisonous.
Ah! Really?
Yes, but I'd say they'd both grow happily in the conditions you describe.
Mm. Which one would be least conspicuous in a salad?
That's a very good question.
But time is running short. We have to move on. Yes, madam.
Mrs. Quentin, I'm thinking of starting a small rock garden and would like to know where to start, really.
Right, Stefan, over to you again.
Well, the golden rule with any kind of rockery is, of course, good drainage.
Good drainage. Which brings me on to my second question. What does the team consider the best way for a woman to achieve a multiple orgasm?
Well, opinions divided on this one, really.
Well, I'm afraid we have to leave Gardener's Question Time. Which gives us another opportunity to hear a much-loved BBC classic.
Come with us on another excursion into the darkest recesses of the unknown in another of our Tales of the Impossible. This week, episode 1 of The Devil's Disciple.
Worshippers of Satan, the hour has come to summon our master and unleash the powers of hell. O Prince of Darkness, the Promised One, the Divine Beast, Lord of Supreme Evil, we who follow you drink to thy power, drink to thy glory in blood. The blood of this virgin. Where's the virgin?
Sorry?
The virgin. Where is the bloody virgin? Well, who was responsible for the sacrifice?
He was.
It was you.
Your virgin monitor?
Look, the last thing I said to you, Friday, after the whisk drive, I said, don't forget your virgin.
Silence! Well, that's just great, isn't it? No virgins, lots to drink. None of you lot are virgins, I suppose.
No,
I thought not. Anyone done it less than 20 times?
No.
40 times?
No. Oh, I don't enjoy it. Does that count?
Afraid not, no.
Look, can't we just skip the virgin sacrificing and go on to the group sex?
Yeah. Nice.
There has to be a sacrifice first.
Mm. Well, we could sacrifice a living creature. Oh, like a goat.
Well, stat me. I seem to have come out without my goat.
What do you know?
Any living creature would do, wouldn't it?
Here's an earwig.
O Prince of Darkness, we drink to thy power. We drink to thy omnipotent glory in the blood of this Earwig. No, I'm sorry. It feels silly. Besides, it's too small to get the pentangle around his neck.
Let's just get on with the group sex.
Look, will you shut up about the group sex? It is a powerful demonic ritual, not an office party. To invoke the powers of darkness, we must sacrifice something. Something symbolic. Something potent.
Well, can we get a move on? Only I go on duty in an hour.
On duty?
Yeah, with the wheel clamping unit.
Get your hands off me! Get your hands off me!
We thank you, O Prince of Darkness, for sending us this sacrifice. And we drink to thy power in the blood of this git.
Next week, Satan's followers perpetrate the ritualistic slaughter of the entire inland revenue in The Devil's Disciples.
Well, welcome back once more to Gardener's Question Time. Sorry for the break. May we have the next question, please?
Yes. As a prize grower of chrysanthemums, I'd like to know what kind of measure the team would recommend to protect my garden from would-be spies and saboteurs.
Right. Stefan.
Well, of course, this is always a problem with prize growers. All I can recommend is good fences and eternal vigilance.
So you couldn't shoot no one then?
For looking at your chrysanthemums?
Yes.
No.
Well, why...
Can we have our last question? And could it please be of a specific gardening nature? Yes.
Well, my husband and I have this beautifully seeded, very lush lawn. It was very green. Well, it's lovely.
Mm-hmm. And what's the question?
Well, if we made love on that, I mean, would that help me achieve a multiple orgasm?
Oh,
You're listening to Radio 4, and now it's comedy. With a million-pound radio show.
Good evening, and welcome. On tonight's show, we'll be looking at the connection between TV and violence, and in particular, the link between Debbie Greenwood and self-mutilation.
And we look at the Republicans as they choose their next presidential candidate. Apparently this time it will be somebody who can chew his own food. But first, I was thrown by that announcer before the show. Now, we've got to straighten this out. Come on, now.
Yeah, no, we'll sort it out after the show.
No, I want to sort it out now.
Andy, come back. Andy!
She's up here somewhere. The announcers have a room in the attic.
Andy!
Look, we'll just cut through the hospitality room.
So that's why they call it the hospitality room.
Excuse me, Mr. Tebbit. Sorry. Right, up here.
Andy. Listen, you will be diplomatic about this, won't you?
Of course I will, Nick. Oi, you. I've got a complaint.
Yes, it's unsightly, isn't it?
Now just doing jokes now. Very, very, very funny, yeah. I'm talking about the way you announced our programme. Do it again.
And now it's comedy with a million-pound radio show.
Exactly.
What's wrong with that?
Where's the little laugh in the voice, Shiny?
Right. And now it's comedy with the million-pound radio show.
You see, it's comedy, so you laugh when you say the word comedy. Any idiot knows that. That's what they do on ITV. And put a bit more wackiness into the voice.
Wackiness.
I'm a BBC announcer, not a disc jockey.
What's going on here?
Who are you?
I'm the chief announcer of the BBC. Now, what's going on?
It's her, Frosty Face. She's not putting the little laugh in her voice when she says the word comedy. She's a dead loss. Give her the sack.
Really? Gerald, I want this horrible little oik removed from
me. It's all right, Sonia. I'll deal with this.
Sonia and Gerald, is it? Yeah, I thought so.
Come on, Andy, come on.
Is this the old story? Small-time pushy announcer dabbles in hanky-panky with her boss. Yeah, it's Ann Diamond all over again.
Andy?
How dare you?
Makes me sick, mate. We know what you posh announcers get up to. All the groping that goes on during those long intros to Radio 3 operas.
What?
Yeah. And what about that time you two were caught in the stationery cupboard together then, eh?
We were looking for some green felt tips.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, there were quite a few tips being felt from what I heard.
Out! Come on, out! I'm reporting you to the Director General.
Well, Andy, you handled that one very diplomatically.
You think so?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They could do with you at the Geneva Arms Talk.
Yes, I'd soon get things moving.
Yeah, armies probably. You know your trouble, why you get wound up like that? It's because you don't relax. Mm. You should go out and relax. Mm. I mean, the other week I went to the Royal Academy.
What? You went to the Royal Academy?
Yeah.
Did you think it was a pub or something?
I'm not a complete yob, you know, Andy. I do know what and where the Royal Academy is.
I'm sorry, sir.
I was going there to score some drugs. No, only joking, officer. Now, there was this amazing exhibition on of early icons from Greece.
Oh, right.
You know what an icon is, don't you?
Of course I do. Of course I know what an icon is, yeah.
Well?
Well, what?
Well, I'd really like to hear your definition of an icon.
Well, Nick, to put it into terms that you as a layman would understand.
Yes?
An icon. Well, it is perhaps best summed up by the phrase, great oaks do from little icons grow.
Just checking.
Okay. Yeah. With us tonight on I Believe, we have the Reverend Trevor Soames and the Bishop of Leeds, Roger Donnelly. And tonight we're looking at a central question which confronts all Christian believers. Namely, if there is a God, why does he allow Bonnie Langford to happen? Bishop.
Well, I must admit that the very first time I actually saw Bonnie Langford, it shook my faith very badly indeed. I just couldn't take in the enormity of the suffering and misery that was being inflicted upon millions of innocent people. But then I thought, hang on. God may have created Bonnie Langford the person, but man chose to create Bonnie Langford the pestilence. So you see, she's a symbol of human failure.
Yes, now a lot of Christians see her as a sort of test sent by God.
Yes, I can't accept that. It presupposes a level of divine cruelty that I find inconceivable.
Now, Reverend Soames, you take a much more sort of Old Testament view.
Yes, I do. I believe that based on scripture, Bonnie Langford is a tool of Satan heralding the start of Armageddon.
Now you claim that Bonnie Langford can be found in the book of Revelation.
Chapter 4, yes. And there shall be a wailing and a terrible gnashing of teeth. And if that's not a description of Bonnie Langford singing, I'd like to know what is.
No. This is the old superstition and mumbo-jumbo we put behind us in the modern church. She is not a tool of Satan. She is a reminder of human weakness.
Just listen to this.
Oh, it was just, I just crashed into the scenery. It's totally my own fault.
You're right. She is a tool of Satan.
Later, we'll be talking to the man who invented car alarms. We won't actually be interviewing him here in the studio. We're going to ring him up at 3 o'clock in the bloody morning.
And go, woo, 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 down the phone. Mm.
Then we'll wait 20 minutes and do it again. But first, let's go over live to Murray Walker.
And the news here at Brown's Hatch is that in third position is Britain's very own Nigel Mansell in the turbocharged Honda Williams. In second position is Alain Prost in the McLaren, but leading the field is Tom Spackman, a travelling salesman in a green Ford Sierra. from the firm's transport pool. Tom was not originally entered in the Grand Prix, but we understand he felt compelled to participate because he couldn't bear the thought of any car in Britain driving faster than him. And believe me, this boy is ruthlessly competitive. In practice, I watched Tom overtake the great Nelson Piquet on the inside on a bend while talking to his boss on the Vodafone. And listening to Meatloaf on the compact disc. Tom's the clear favourite to win. He's got the edge because he's fast, he's aggressive, and most important of all, it's a company car, so he just does not care. And now back to Andy in the studio.
Right,
You okay, Andy?
A bit tired, isn't
it? Yeah, you look at those bags under your eyes, they're enormous. It's lucky we're not on TV, or Barry Norman would have you for copyright.
Yeah, well I was babysitting last night.
Babysitting? Yeah. How the hell did you land yourself with that one, then?
Well, I saw these two old friends of mine at a party, and I only offered because I was drunk at the time.
Well, let that be a lesson to you. I've given up doing that at parties now.
What, drinking?
Nah, talking to any friends of mine with kids.
I wish I had, I tell you.
Andy, hi. Good of you to come.
Hi, Sarah.
Damien, this is Andy.
Hi, Damien.
Hello.
Behave yourself, understand?
Yes, Mummy.
See you later, Andy.
Okay, you have a good time in here, okay?
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Well, Damien, would you like a drink before you go up the hills of Bedfordshire?
You haven't done babysitting before, have you?
No.
So, your name's Andy?
Yes, that's right.
What's your second name?
Hamilton.
Oh, I thought it was, oh no, not him.
Why?
Because every time you phone up, my mum says, it's Andy, and my dad says, oh no, not him.
Really?
Would you like me to pour you a gin and tonic?
Well, thank you, Damien. I might have one later.
Well, I'm having one now.
Now, look, Damien. Look, Damien, come back. I'm not going to let you. You're far too young to be drinking alcohol.
Ever seen that film, The Omen?
Yeah, it's a horror movie, isn't it?
Yeah. It's about this little boy, and he's the Antichrist.
Right.
His name's Damien.
Well, what a coincidence.
Yes. You've known Mummy and Daddy a long time, haven't you?
Yes, we were at university together, yeah.
You've known Mummy longer, though, haven't you?
Yes, I have. Well, tell me, Damien, how old are you now?
7. I've got a very advanced reading age.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I can even read joined-up writing, if it's tidy.
Well, that's very good, yes.
Your writing's very tidy, isn't it?
Yes, it is quite tidy. Hang on, wait, well, how do you know that?
Mummy keeps all our old letters.
Really?
Really. And all the not-so-old letters. Can I have that gin now?
No, you can't. Now, look, I'll tell you what, Damien. Why don't we watch a video together,
okay?
Oh, here's a nice one.
What is it?
Thomas the Tank Engine.
Oh, that's Mummy's. Let's watch this one.
No, you're not watching Driller Killer, Damien. I'm sorry.
I'll get it.
Damien, who is it?
Who's this?
This is Andy. Andy, this is my girlfriend, Tara.
Girlfriend?
Yeah, don't look so surprised. Haven't you ever had any girlfriends?
Funny you should say that, Tara.
Now, look here, Damien, OK? It's 8 o'clock and your mum told me that you should be in bed by 8 o'clock.
I'm surprised you believe anything my mum tells you.
Eh?
Well, she wrote and told you she wanted to stop seeing you for a while she put things in perspective, didn't she?
Yeah, but...
And 2 weeks later, she married my dad.
Really? How tragic.
Yeah. Andy was clearly upset. His writing got all untidy and hard to read.
Now, come on, bed, or I'll carry you up myself.
Mum was still very fond of Andy, though.
Really?
Yes. They used to see each other on Saturdays when Daddy was playing rugby.
Oh.
Can I have that gin now?
No, you can't.
Of course, when you've got a temper like my dad's, you've got to work it off doing something like rugby. Time for that gin, I reckon, Sarah.
Please.
Now, look, you two, for the last time, I told you, you are too young to drink gin.
Yes, terrible temper, my dad. And talk about jealous. He broke someone's jaw last week.
Oh, God.
The man just happened to say, what an attractive woman Mummy was.
Oh, God.
Just like you keep saying in those letters, Andy. Have some lemon, Tara.
Please, not too much tonic.
You want one, Andy?
Yeah.
Large one?
Yeah.
Thought so. Shall we watch Driller Killer now?
Yeah, I'll put it in the machine, yeah. And now.
1854. The Crimea. The Light Brigade stand waiting to do battle. Ahead of them lies the valley of death, flanked by the Russian guns. Suddenly, a voice rings out.
Oh, bugger this, I'm bored. Let's do something futile. Charge!
And so they charged into the valley of death. For immortality, for glory, and most of all, for the chance to get hospitalized and pull Florence Nightingale. These men and many more go to make up the glory that is the British Army. The British Army has defended these islands' interests for centuries, fighting against the French, the Dutch, the French again, the Russians, the Prussians, the Germans, the Japanese, and hopefully soon the French again. Its annals are steeped with heroes like those brave British soldiers who, in 1776, fought against the American rebels.
The men are ready, sir.
Okay, men. Now, these are your orders. You're to climb up to the brow of that hill and then stand in a nice straight line in your bright red uniforms. Proceed.
They've all been shot dead from behind those trees, sir.
Yes, that keeps happening. Well, damn bad luck. Still, let's stick at it. Our luck's got to turn sooner or later. Call up the reserve.
Reserve squadron, get to the top of that hill and stand in a nice straight line in your bright red uniforms and no flinching.
The British Army proved their courage again and again in the Boer War.
Okay, men, get in a nice straight line and walk towards the lager in your bright red uniforms.
And, of course, on the Somme.
Okay, men, get in a nice straight line and walk towards the machine guns in your khaki uniforms.
They're all dead, sir. Just lying there. Khaki figures in the mud.
It's madness. Madness. We should never have got rid of those bright red uniforms.
I agree. It's nice to get dressed up for the big occasion.
Well,
isn't
exactly,
it?
And no one makes an effort.
Nobody makes an effort.
Where's the respect?
The heroic infantry have always been the backbone of the British Army. Wellington knew how important they were as he rallied them on the eve of Waterloo.
Okay, guys. You want success, am I right? And we want success, yeah? So let's build Success City together and really go for it. Woo, yeah!
This approach was only a qualified success. The advance of the infantry at Waterloo was slow because every time a British soldier killed a Frenchman, the whole British army had to stop, applaud him and shout, Yo! It has often been said that the Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Eton. This is untrue. It was won at Waterloo. If it had been won at Eton, it would be called the Battle of Eton. Perhaps the British Army's most legendary campaign was the First World War, which saw so many acts of heroism. From the Scots Guards, the Hampshire Regiment, and most noble of all, the Poets' Brigade.
Okay, men. This is it. Charge!
What?
I should die. How's it going, Corporal?
It's no use, sir. The Germans are cutting our boys down before they get as far as the second stanza. Some of our lads are completely run out of imagery and rhymes. They've been reduced to marching suicidally towards Jerry going dee-dum-dee-dum-dee-dum-dee-dum. It's carnage, sir. Just dead poets everywhere.
How many dead?
About enough for two anthologies.
The First World War threw into high relief the strong fabric of the British Army. At the bottom, you had the loyal, patriotic soldier, the ordinary man, known as the Simple Tommy,
Then you have an elite of highly motivated, resourceful, intelligent men known as deserters. Then you have the officers, upper-class boys who sometimes found the going hard in the trenches.
Well, Corporal, Jerry seems to have pinned us down. Tricky situation.
With respect, sir, I say we attack.
Sergeant?
Yes, sir. Take the crowds by surprise, sir.
Yes. What do you say, Nanny?
The First World War was to prove a nightmare of attrition, and every day the news grew grimmer and grimmer for Lloyd George until in 1917.
Well, gentlemen, the news is bad, very bad. We've been fighting for 3 long years now. Millions upon millions of our young men have perished, and now comes the worst blow of all. We've forgotten what the war was about. Now, obviously, this would be a bit embarrassing for us to admit. So, come on, somebody must remember. Yes, Haig.
I think I recall something about the Kaiser skewering babies on his pointed helmet and then eating them.
Oh, me too, I remember that.
Good, good, that's good. Are you sure it's true?
Read it in the Daily Express.
Oh, bugger.
Yes? It's German High Command, Prime Minister.
Pray God they want an armistice. We can have peace at last. Lloyd George speaking. Well, isn't that funny? Neither can we. No, I haven't got a clue. Can't remember. One of our chaps said he thought we decided to fight you to defend the Belgians. Yes, well, that's what I said. Well, listen, it seems silly to be locked in this stalemate for nothing. All right, agreed. One more big offensive each. And if that doesn't produce a result by 1918, we'll both chuck it in and attack the Russians.
Very jolly good idea.
But there was a result. And Germany was crushed, only to rise again under Hitler. Britain stood alone, and Hitler seemed on the brink of victory. Churchill summoned his advisers.
Bad news, gentlemen. The Dunkirk was not a defeat, but a victory line doesn't seem to be fooling anybody. Things look grim. We must do something.
Now,
any news of the Americans?
Ladies, tradition, Prime Minister, is that the Americans won't enter the war until John Wayne's agent has negotiated his fee.
It is essential that the Americans are involved in this war now. So grab a brush and help me paint Japanese insignia on these Spitfires.
The ruse worked. The British army was joined in battle by the Americans. Leading the British advance was the military genius, General Montgomery. He was an obvious target for the Germans, so the British used an actor to impersonate their commander-in-chief, a tactic still used by the Americans to this day. After World War II, the British soldier reverted to his normal peacetime duties, such as blowing up sheep on the Brecon Beacons, playing Amazing Grace very badly on Cup Final Day, and getting very, very drunk in Aldershot. All duties which are part of the glory that is the British Army. Well, that's it for this week. Next week, we'll be looking at the difference between a prawn and a shrimp. A prawn, of course, is what you get on the menu in an expensive restaurant, and a shrimp is what you get on your plate.
And we'll be examining growing concern over the Pentagon's Star Wars battle computer after the Soviet Union is showered with incorrect gas bills. Good night.
The Million Pound Radio Show was written and presented by Andy Hamilton and Nick Revel and featured Felicity Montague and Jasper Jacobs. The show was produced by Paul Mayhew Archer.